All right. Good morning, everybody. It just feels really subdued in here or something. Mike, yeah, but there are no leaks. Think of that. Woohoo! They actually re-roofed the entire place. So thank you to our landlords and everybody involved in that. Mike, I'm just booming up here. And it's intimidating me. You know how that goes. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. Hey, so this morning we're going to continue in our study of the book of Revelation. So we're going to dive right into it. If you have a Bible or a Bible app and you want to follow along, if you'll find your way over to Revelation chapter 17, please. You know, the Bible is recognized all over by all peoples as being one of the greatest sources of ancient poetry that we have. I mean, there's some of the most beautiful examples of ancient poetic writing found in the Bible. And of course, none more so clearly represented as in the book of Psalms, which is a book of poetry for us in the Old Testament. And an example from the Old Testament that just stands out so poignantly and lyrically is from the first half of Psalm 137, where it says, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I don't remember you." And obviously, it's a lament. It's beautifully written. It conveys so much emotionally. But, you know, it's a song written while the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon. And it's a song of lament, of being homesick. And these are for people who may have even been born in Babylon. But it's a poetic reminder that while they may have been living in that foreign place, it will never be home. It'll never be who they were really meant to be. They'll never really be themselves there by the waters of Babylon. The book of Revelation, as we've been going through it, relies heavily on themes of exile and return, as well as the exodus from Egypt into the promised land. And the reason for that is because the overall emphasis of the book of Revelation is one of encouragement. The writer, John, it's wanting to encourage Christians, reminding Christians of every generation, not just even his original writers, but we believe the Holy Spirit inspired him to write these things down to remind all Christians in any age about what God's big plan is, about what it is that God's doing, that even though it may seem like the world is going crazy, may seem like things are out of control and evil has the upper hand, this book is here calling out to remind us that God is still firmly on the throne, that God is in control and his big plan, his plan to restore all things is still fully underway, to put everything back to original order and to remove evil from the equation of this world. The book of Revelation communicates that encouragement through what we have described as the apocalyptic literature style. Apocalyptic, remember, doesn't necessarily convey the idea of cataclysm the way we think of apocalyptic. We think Mad Max, but it's more than that. It can include that, but what apocalyptic actually means is revealing things that have been hidden. So this is revealing the hidden things behind what we see and observe naturally by using metaphor and symbolic language to convey a deeper truth about the world, to describe the world in a different way so that we can see it differently and maybe understand it differently. So we've moved into the final section of this book, and John has had a series of visions of different judgments, and we've gotten into the vision of the seven bowls of judgment. Again, it's symbolic language here, nothing literal in this, but these judgments are poured out over the world, and it results in what we see in the world even to this day of nature working against humanity. It helps us to even understand why things are the way they are in this world as we live in it, and why conflicts and wars are increasing and immune systems are breaking down. And all of it is leading towards this climactic showdown between the world's universal determination to rebel against God's rule and God's kingdom, this great clash between the kingdoms of this world and God's kingdom. And all of this, I believe, is describing, you've heard me explain this before, and again, I'll remind you, you don't have to agree with me, but I believe this is describing the fallen conditions of this world as we're waiting for Jesus' return. Matthew 24, Jesus told us, gave us clues about what this world would be like in between his ascension and his return. And so there's this, in the book of Revelation, there's this repeated cyclical pattern describing these calamities that are going on in the world, and they seem to be spiraling towards an intensification, a heightened intensity. More and greater wars, worse and more devastating natural disasters, you know, percentages increasing to 100% of people involved or affected. And, you know, it's all of this is trying to indicate to us that there is something wrong with this world as it is right now. When we look at this world, we're not seeing something that should be normalized in our thinking. And this is what we're seeing, all around us. This is the judgment of God, in that God has stepped aside and has allowed the evil of this world to begin running its course towards its own destruction. So in the final bowl that was poured out, we read about this final cataclysm. And again, this has been repeated. This is the third time we've read it in the book of Revelation, that brought about the destruction of everything. God wipes the whole corrupted system off of the stage in order to restore all things back to his original order. And in that description of that calamity, the great city Babylon was described as being destroyed in this earthquake, splitting into three parts. In other words, three being a number of completion in the book of Revelation, meaning this city, this great city Babylon, completely destroyed. The three parts, meaning it's gone. And now in chapters, as we pick up here, chapters 17 through 19, or part of 20, is going to actually go back in now and look at some of these things in detail to get a better picture of what it is that God's trying to communicate through this imagery to us. So by looking at some of the details of these things, so I'm saying that when we get to chapter 17, we're not necessarily moving in a chronology, I don't believe. We're not necessarily saying, okay, and then after these bowls, now we go into this next thing. I believe what we're going to do is look back at some of the details from those bowls, and we'll see that even as we start it here. We're going to be looking again at the image of Babylon, and we'll get another word picture to help describe this symbolic city and gain some insight here as to why it's so challenging to live as a Christ follower, to live as a Christian, a disciple of Jesus in this fallen world as we're living here by the waters of Babylon. And so if you're there in Revelation 17, that was my introduction, we're going to jump in here and begin with verse 1. It says, one of the seven angels who had poured out the seven bowls came over and spoke to me. So again, we're putting this in the context. This is not moving on to something else. We're still in this context of these angels with the bowls in this. Came over and spoke to me. Come with me, he said, and I'll show you the judgment that's going to come on the great prostitute who rules over many waters. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her, and the people who belong to this world have been made drunk by the wine of her immorality. So the angel took me in the spirit into the wilderness. And there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that had seven heads and 10 horns, and blasphemies against God were written all over it. The woman wore purple and scarlet clothing and beautiful jewelry made of gold and precious gems and pearls. In her hand she held a gold goblet full of obscenities and impurities of her immorality. A mysterious name was written on her forehead, Babylon the Great, mother of all prostitutes and obscenities in the world. I could see that she was drunk with the blood of God's holy people who were witnesses for Jesus. All right, we're going to stop there in the middle of that verse. We'll come back and pick it up here in a second. But let's look at this. As the bowls of judgment are poured out, one of the angels suddenly stops and looks right at John and says, hey, you, come with me. I got something to show you here. And he's going to see the judgment on someone he identifies as the great prostitute. And she's described as influential, and that world leaders are described as committing adultery with her. And the population at large is said to be getting drunk on the wine of her skewed moral views, her immorality, her views that are not lining up with God's perspective on life. And so we remind ourselves again that this is symbolic language. You know, some people, when they'll read this section and they roll their eyes right away. Oh, of course, the patriarchal Bible is going to come up with a symbol for evil, and what could be more symbolic of evil than a promiscuous woman? Well, there you go. The men are in charge, etc. But listen, that's not necessarily consistent through the Bible. In Proverbs, God's wisdom, Sophia, is represented as a woman. It's not that, but what this is, think in terms of a normal archetype that we see, a normal trope we see in literature or even media of the femme fatale. You know what we're talking about in that. It's not necessarily an attack on women. It's just describing someone who is seductive in their own way, but dangerous as well. And that can go, there's the homo fatale as well, but the femme fatale is probably more prominent simply because it undoes the normal power structures. Anyway, that's beside the point. The point is that this is symbolic language. He's not talking about women or prostitution here. He's using seduction and promiscuity and drunkenness as an image of something else. He's not addressing those issues. He's addressing something else. In prior instances in this book, it's illustrating idolatry. It's illustrating unfaithfulness to God. And so that's more than likely what we're supposed to be understanding when we see this woman. So let's look at the details of this. She's described as sitting on a beast that we met back in chapter 13, the monster with 7 heads and 10 horns, and she's decked out in all the accoutrements of material wealth. And she's drinking in everything that's obscene and dehumanizing. And she also has a name on her forehead, like the followers of the beast had a name on their forehead and the followers of Jesus had a name on their forehead. She has a name, and it is Babylon the Great, mother of all prostitutes. That is that she is propagating something here. She gives birth to more like her. She propagates what she is in the world. She's not in isolation. And she's drunk from drinking the blood of martyrs. In other words, she is the driving force behind the persecution that's ending up killing people of our faith. So our task in reading this is to figure out what this represents. And one thing that's happening here, if we were to take this book as a whole, when the first listeners got this, somebody would come in saying, hey, John wrote a letter to the churches. He'd gather the people all around and you would sit down and you would read it from beginning to end. And in some ways that's a really, it takes a long time. I listen to a person read it from beginning to end, and that's a couple hours of sitting there listening to it. And, the imagery starts to kind of swirl in your head as you're trying to listen to it and grasp a hold of it. But in some ways, that's kind of good. And if we were to read this whole thing in one sitting, we would realize that a contrast is actually being made here. But this is the first side of that contrast. Because we look at the similarities of something that gets presented later on in this book. Let me just show it to you. Here in chapter 17, verse 1, it says that the angels, one of the 7 angels who had poured out the 7 bowls, came over and spoke to me. Come with me, he said. I'll show you the judgment that's coming on the great prostitute. We go over to chapter 21, 9. One of the 7 angels who held the 7 bowls containing the 7 last plagues came to me and said, come with me. I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So we see a contrast right away. Same thing happens in verse 3. The angel took me by the Spirit into the wilderness. I saw the woman sitting on the scarlet beast. We get to verse or chapter 21, verse 10. He took me in the Spirit to a great high mountain, and he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. Instead of Babylon, it's the holy city descending out of heaven. So what we have here is a contrast. We've got the antithesis of a bride here, the opposite of God's city represented here, the opposite of God's kingdom, the anti-bride, the anti-kingdom are what is in view. But still, we have to puzzle out what that's applied to. Like, what are we applying? We get it. Okay, it's the anti-bride, it's the anti-kingdom, but what is that talking about? And how does that apply to us as followers of Jesus? So let's keep reading, continuing on in verse 6. I stared at her in amazement. Why are you amazed? The angel asked. I'll tell you the mystery of this woman and the beast with the 7 heads and the 10 horns on which she sits. I just got to stop right there because this part is, I just love this. This is, I love it. It's delightful. It's very human of John. John stares at this woman in amazement. And, in the English, as we're reading that, we conjure up different ideas of what that means. What he's amazed at this. But many commentators point out here that the word that's used here is the same one that's used in chapter 13 for people who are amazed and astonished at the beast and worship him. And the word in the Greek there is not saying that he's just startled or whatever. The word in the Greek means great admiration for something or someone. John isn't surprised or shocked by what it is that he's looking at. John is feeling seduced as he's looking at her. Not in some erotic sense, but he's tantalized by what he sees. He's suddenly feeling himself drawn into this. The appeal of this is right there on the surface for him. So much so that the angel basically has to say, hey, snap out of it. I'm trying to show you something. I'll show you who this woman is and what this beast is and where this is all leading. It may seem enticing, but this is going somewhere you don't want to go. Which is an important lesson for all of us who are disciples of Jesus. Anyway, it goes on. Verse 8. The beast you saw was once alive, but isn't now, and yet will soon come up out of the bottomless pit and go to eternal destruction. And the people who belong to this world, whose names were not written in the book of life before the world was made, will be amazed at the reappearance of this beast who had died. This calls for a mind with understanding. The seven heads of the beast represent the seven hills where the woman rules. They also represent seven kings. Five kings have already fallen, and the sixth now reigns, and the seventh is yet to come, but his reign will be brief. The scarlet beast that was, but is no longer, is the eighth king. He's like the other seven, and he too is headed for destruction. The ten horns of the beast are ten kings who have not yet risen to power. They'll be appointed to their kingdoms for one brief moment to reign with the beast. In the NLT, it says one brief moment, it says an hour, but more than likely that is what's trying to be conveyed in that sense, an hour or for a brief moment. Verse 13, they'll all agree to give him their power and authority. Together, they'll go to war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will defeat them because he's Lord of all lords and King of all kings. He and his called and his chosen and faithful ones will be with him. Then the angel said to me, the waters where the prostitute is ruling represent masses of people of every nation and language. The scarlet beast and his ten horns all hate the prostitute. They'll strip her naked, eat her flesh, and burn her remains with fire. For God has put a plan into their minds, a plan that will carry out his purposes. They'll all agree to give their authority to the scarlet beast, and so the words of God will be fulfilled. And this woman you saw in your vision represents the great city that rules over all, over the kings of the world. Okay. I keep telling that joke of saying, well, that's it. You can go now because nobody needs to explain that. Obviously, this is extremely cryptic. It's like watching one of those history specials on Nostradamus or something. Like, what are you talking about here? This is a lot of cryptic writings in this and mysterious. And of course, as with the whole book of Revelation, there are a multitude of differing approaches as to how to interpret all of this dense imagery here. And listen, we don't have time this morning to give fair treatment to all the various ways in which it's looked at, but we'll look at a few. But what I want to do is start with Babylon, because there is almost, within conservative scholarship, there is almost a consensus on why it is that Babylon is invoked in this situation here. When John was writing this, the actual city of Babylon had been long gone. It had been destroyed many years prior to that. But the imagery that the name conjures up is used multiple times throughout Scripture. Babylon is derived from the word Babel, which takes us all the way back to prehistory in Genesis 11, where we have this picture of humanity striving to cooperate to build something that rises up to heaven, a tower to get to heaven without involving God in the process. And the story of, you know how the story goes, God confuses the languages, there's no unity apart from God, there's no unified ability to attain to these things apart from God. So in the scriptures, and this is fairly well agreed upon, Babylon is code for humanity's efforts to create a society or religion or ethos without God. It's the rejection of Creator God, an attempt to recreate heaven in our own image without submitting to the rule of God. And the waters of Babylon are the multitudes of people that are swept into this effort, this determined effort to make our own heaven. We don't need God in this. Now, in the Old Testament, a lot of different cities were referred to as Babylon. Nineveh was called Babylon. Tyre was called Babylon. Greece was called Babylon. Babylon was called Babylon, amazingly enough. In John's day, Rome was clearly in view as Babylon, or at least as the beast carrying Babylon was Rome. And the reference to the seven heads of the beast being seven mountains, that is a clear marker to as Rome. That's inescapable as far as I'm concerned. Rome was built on seven hills. They had an annual festival called Septimontium, which was the celebration of seven mountains. Seven hills, seven mountains. That is about as clear as we're going to get. Now, some have taken that and extrapolated that onto what they believe is the extension of the Roman Empire as the Roman Catholic Church. I disagree with that concept altogether, but that's out there. You'll come across it here and there. Again, we have to remember this is symbolic stuff. I don't believe that this is meant to peg the beast as Rome and then be done with it. You know, there we go. There's the beast. That's Rome. Because the number seven is also significant in this book. While there were seven literal hills that the city of Rome was built on, seven gets employed in this book in a very symbolic way, meaning it's complete or total as well. So I think that there's something significant in that. There are seven heads, seven mountains, seven kings. To me, it's a way of saying it's the head, it's the mountain, it's the king in totality. It's all of them together. It is the monster, all of it together, working together as this beast. For John's readers, it would make sense. That would have been Rome, but we have to look through that to the deeper meaning in all of this. Babylon is the progenitor of Babylon's. Rome was just another particular embodiment of humanity's effort to build heaven without God. Rome was just one aspect of that. There were many before Rome. There have been many since Rome. There are many today. And all of them are heading towards a fall. All of these things, all of these systems, these empires and ethoses are destined to fall. That is the message of Revelation. Still, we have all these other details of kings that were, but aren't, but will be again, an eighth king and 10 other kings. And, you know, what do we make of all? How do we keep track of all of these kings and what's it supposed to be? Now, this, again, admittedly, is some of the most complex, puzzling, and controversial stuff in this whole book. Let me just throw a few different ways in which people approach this. I'll give you my opinion. Again, you pray about that and see how the Lord leads you. But some believe this is referring to successive emperors of Rome. When he's marching these things across the stage like this, they look at the calendar and begin trying to assign significance from historic events. Problem is if you count from the first Roman Empire, Julius Caesar, the first emperor after the fall of the Republic, it doesn't work out the way that he's described it here. The numbers aren't going to match up when we get to John's timeline of this. There's too many kings. By the time we reach the time that we're pretty sure that John was writing this, we're way past 6, 7, and 8. So some start with the number of the emperor at the time of Jesus' birth, Augustus. We can start there then, and it still didn't work out. You still got to monkey around with it. So then others go back to the idea this is all being about Nero. Remember there was the rumor that went around saying that Nero hadn't really died and that he was going to come back and with an army of Parthians. And so the rumors were abounding. And so they say, well, this is about that. And so they count from Nero. But again, it doesn't work. And it gets so convoluted by the time we have to keep monkeying around with all of these guys and shifting them. Well, if we take this one out or add this one in or discount those because it was four in 1 year or whatever. To me, once you get that convoluted with it, it loses steam. I'm not convinced. It doesn't impress me or persuade me anymore. Some believe then that this is talking about successive empires. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece. The sixth would be Rome. The seventh would be a future empire. And the eighth would be this king who embodies that. Some future ruler or global leader who is the embodiment of this rebellion against God, this beast, the Antichrist or the figure of the Antichrist. And that is certainly more reasonable to me as we're looking this over and trying to make heads or tails out of it. But I will suggest that there is a third way of understanding this, to recognize the symbolism of this book and to see this as symbolic of the whole of humanity's empires and ethoses. Seven is, of course, the divine number of completeness in this. And so, to me, when I look at this, I believe we're looking at the history of the world in this. They come and they go. They weren't here. They are here. They come and they go. There's 10. There's less. There's more. But all of them, all of it is representative of this beast, of man, of humanity's efforts to try to create some sort of paradise here on this broken world that doesn't include God or his will or his original intent. And we see this just cycling through history over and over and over again. They come and they go, but they're still all part of this system. The 10 kings, again, such a tidy number, and 10, as we've talked about before, is representative of the number of human completeness, because as human beings, we've got 10 fingers, and you know, once you've counted on your fingers, you get to 10, you're done. There's no more numbers, or that's it. At least that's the way it is for me. But, you know, so, you know, that's the concept, human completeness in all of this, all of humanity's efforts, their full extent of their efforts, all of these kings, and they are in the, you know, coming up in the future, they'll continue on in this. Now, others have seen this, I'll just throw that out, that others have seen these 10 kings as a future alliance of European nations, and certainly I would suppose that that's a possibility. But for me, I'm more comfortable seeing this as a symbolic picture of the whole, because again, even with the European nations, it just gets so perplexing because the numbers don't match up with these. Then it's never as tidy in the real world as it is in these numbers that are presented here, which suggests to me that we're not looking at statistics, we're looking at symbols. So for me, the woman in this is like the false prophet that we saw in chapter 13, or we could say the spirit of the age, the ethos of fallen society, and the beast that she rides on are the governments of this fallen world that advance that ethos, that whole idea of how we derive our values and morals and ethics apart from God. And again, the idea of coming together to fight against God's kingdom is presented. Third time we've seen this happen. And they're defeated by the one who is the Lord of Lords and the King of all kings. And what's fascinating is that Jesus doesn't do anything to defeat this system here. The beast itself turns on the system and ruins it all. So we got all these different images. We got all these things. What does this mean? I mean, you know, it's all interesting. We could sit here and we could project this onto the calendar. We could project this onto the newspaper and look and see, does this match up with that or whatever? But really, when it touches our lives, like we get up in the morning, you know, after you've brushed your teeth and you're looking at the day, you're drinking your coffee. You brush your teeth before you drink coffee? What? It doesn't matter. Either way, as we're trying to figure out how it is that we're going to approach our day as followers of Jesus, as disciples who are following Jesus, what does this mean to us? I mean, what do we figure about this? I think there are a few things. I think there are a few things that we can pull from this, regardless of how we interpret this. I think that there's some inherent truths in this. We're presented with a picture of the world that is very, very different from the way that we observe it with the natural eye. And I believe these pictures here serve as warnings to us about how it is that our ethics, that our morals, that our understanding of priorities are shaped. Who is it that shapes us? It's a very important question. Because for one thing, we're warned that the systems of this world, just like John when he was looking at that woman, the systems of this world are very attractive. They're very seductive. And one of the main reasons that they are so is because the systems of this world emphasize power and sensuality. That's when we look at the way that this world operates, from the governments to the ethics that dominate our societal norms. This is what dominates that. And by systems, that's what I mean, the political, ethical systems that are in power and influence us as a society, as individuals that make up that society. The urge for power over people is highly seductive. I mean, that's the whole thing. Human beings, we want control. We want to have the power, by and large, because the world becomes such a scary place. It alleviates our fears. We're so afraid of so much stuff that if we can have power and we can exercise that power over people, well, we can insulate ourselves from trouble. That's why political engines gain so much momentum. And it just seems so important, all of the stuff that's going on within the political worlds of the empires of humanity that are moving through history. It seems so important to us. And, you know, it'll divide us up. It's divided this church up before. All these various political perspectives on how it is that this nation needs to be shaped properly. But all of them, left, right, and center, all of them are defining paradise by their own image. From their own perspective, from that fallen state of grasping for power, seeking power over people in order to force that image of paradise on to the unwilling. This is the way of every human political system. It is the way that they work, and it's the opposite way that God rules. It's the opposite of God's kingdom. It is historically and presently the anti-kingdom of God. And I'm just saying, guys, that as followers of Christ, as people who have submitted to God's rule and come into His kingdom, there is a different ethos, there's a different priority that should be shaping us, that should be moving us in our choices and what it is that we hitch our Christian cart to. And my fear is that we keep hitching it to carts that are more interested in gaining power over people and insulating us and making life more comfortable for us than we are following Jesus to a cross. Because here's the thing, we can look at it and we can say, well, you know, we got to do what we got to do. You know, we got to keep ourselves safe, and the world's not made it easy for us to live here as Christians. So, you know, I'll turn the other cheek, but I only got two cheeks, so I got to do something. In other words, and I just heard an evangelical leader say that. And in other words, what he's saying in that is that Christianity will only take you so far. But after that, look out, because it could lead you to a cross, and that's not where I'm going. And Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, you got one piece of equipment. You got to pick it up every day. You got to follow me. So where are we going? What city is shaping us? What are we oriented towards? Well, Rob, calm down. I will calm down. I'm going to calm down because, no, I should calm down. Because the natural question that arises is, well, what are you saying? So that's it. That it's all evil. Let's get fatalistic. I shouldn't, you know, I just disengage, right, Rob? We shouldn't have anything to do with anything more. Just drop our duties as citizens or whatever. No. We should engage. Jeremiah told the Israelites who were going off into exile. He told them, build homes and plan to stay. Plant gardens and eat the food that they produce. Marry and have children and work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, for its welfare will determine your welfare. But never forget the promised land. Never forget whose kingdom we are citizens of. As we started in Psalm 137, how can I sing the song of the Lord by these foreign waters? Never forget whose kingdom we put our hope in. We should be good citizens. We should do our part to engage with the system. But always remember what this system is. The system of this world is not the answer. It's not our hope. We do not seek power over people as the kingdom of God. We follow our Messiah to a cross, and through that sacrificial love, we conquer all evil. That's the only path. Okay, Rob. Can you calm down about that? Yes, I will, because power isn't all of it. That's only one equation of seduction. There's also this ethical framework that prioritizes wealth and materialism and temporal pleasure, and that is highly attractive on the baser levels of our human existence. Sensuality, that drive for instant gratification, it stifles all creativity and ingenuity. It was said and I can't remember the source of it, but is in the absence of creativity, only sensuality is left. And I feel like we certainly see that played out in the world around us. It keeps humanity drugged and docile and malleable to be shaped. Sensuality, you know, is more than just sex, but of course that's a large part of it. Human societies historically, inevitably, become obsessed with sexuality because of the instant nature, of the instant gratification of its nature. That sense of being able to get that immediate pleasure that can drug us and forget about the other things going on around us. Defining ourselves by sexuality instead of what we were created for, to be image bearers of God into this creation. To show what God is really like, the depths of his love and what it means to be a human being. But sensuality is also about materialism and greed. The idea that our deepest needs can be addressed by things collected or handled or felt. Everything about our present consumerist society reflects that kind of brokenness. Everything about it. But it doesn't seem broken on the outward appearance. It seems, after a while, like the norm. This is just the way it is. This is how life is. These are the things that are important. John looked at the woman with admiration. This looks pretty good, actually. It's attractive. It's seductive. But we're warned here, remember what this is. Remember what it is. Remember what these empires and these ethoses are. We live by the waters of Babylon, but we don't want to get swept into the current of that. We live in this city, but as the city of God, as a city that operates by a different ethic. In the next chapter, the call is going to go out, come away from her, or get caught up in her destruction, meaning that our priorities and our ethics and our motives must be shaped by God's values. Not this broken world's understanding of right or highest good, but based on what it is that God has revealed through his word, through the ministry of Jesus, through the revelation of God's love, through Jesus' death on our behalf to reconcile us. It needs to be shaped by that and not by this broken world, because as we saw in the vision, the systems of this world are completely passing away because evil inevitably is going to implode on itself. This is a repetitive message in this book. Babylon falls because evil always self-destructs. The natural course of evil is going to end in destruction. The King of Kings doesn't need to fight against Babylon. He doesn't need to do anything to take it down, because the beast devours. The beast turns on itself and eats its own system. I can't think of a more vivid picture of the destructive and self-destructive nature of sin. Devoured. The woman is devoured by the beast that she's sitting on. These world systems, they eventually, inevitably turn in on themselves. God allows it. It's his purpose, not only to reveal that something's gone wrong, but to ensure also that what has gone wrong is going to go away. Because it's got to be removed before all things can be put back together according to his good intention. So God allows evil to follow its course, and its course always leads to destruction. Never to the satisfaction that is promised. Never towards the fulfillment that is presented as that alluring thing. Oh, come into this system. Enjoy the sensuality of this, because that'll make you feel whole. No, it won't. It never does. It's like chewing gum. It loses its flavor after just a minute. So you got to grab another piece and throw it in the mouth and just keep on going and keep on going until... Where are you going with that analogy, Rob? I don't know. And so one day, I guess you get cavities. You go to whatever. I don't know. You come up with an analogy as you're going along and realize it goes nowhere. Okay. So there's something else to pay attention to, because, okay, this has gotten pretty intense, and I apologize for that. It's intense, and we talk about these systems, and the imagery that's employed here is vivid, and it's unnerving, right? I mean, everything that we're reading about is unnerving, and even what we're talking about is unsettling and uncomfortable. But here's the one thing I want to leave us with, and that is that the systems of this world are nothing to be afraid of. And that's, to me, one of the most important things we've got to keep in mind as we even go through the whole book of Revelation. Because we could, wind up, you know, with this startling and disturbing imagery. We could, you know, monsters and lust and fire and destruction. And the whole thing gets so traumatizing. And I believe that it's meant to be vivid in order to get our attention. Because that dramatic imagery then, it sharpens our choices about what city is going to shape us. And it's right for us to consider that, to think about that and pray about that. It's not up to me to tell you what city is dominant in your life. That's something for the Holy Spirit and you to work out as God leads you through this life. But what we don't want to do, and this is so important, we don't want to become fearful of these images of fallen things like this. We don't want to become paranoid or superstitious in how it is that we engage with Babylon or the waters of Babylon. We don't want to, you know, become fearful and reactive because of that. When I was in the crazy church, fear was a driving motive for us. I mean, fear of being contaminated by the world, fear of the world's influence or impact on us and what was going to happen. Fear made us so inwardly focused and constantly under pressure to get our Christianity just right or, you know, woo, it could fall apart. Fear then ultimately made us ugly and mean and exclusive because we were so afraid. And again, that's one of the attractions of the world's systems. If we can gain power over people, we don't have to be as afraid anymore, except for the people that are trying to wrest power away from us. But fear, I'm telling you, fear is the worst possible response to Babylon and the beast. So, okay, but if that's the case, then how do we realize our distinction from this fallen world as disciples of Jesus? How do we realize our distinction without inducing fear of this world? How do we do that? How do we not be afraid of the influence of this world or what's going on with this world? You know, if John that's writing this book is the same John who wrote the epistles, he tells us in one of his epistles of a higher motive. He tells about a motive that actually drives fear away. Anybody know what that motive is by any chance? Love. Love. Look at what he said in 1 John 4:17. As we live in God, our love grows more perfect, so we'll not be afraid on the day of judgment. All these things that we're reading about. But we can face Him with confidence because we live like Jesus here in this world. Such love has no fear because perfect love expels all fear. When we embrace God's love for us, when we set out to really believe that God loves us perfectly, we no longer have to be afraid of anything. We're not afraid of political powers. We're not afraid of candidates. We're not afraid of Congress. We're not afraid of the ethics of this world or anything. If we can embrace that love and let God shape us by that love, we get humanized by that love. We find satisfaction and wholeness in His love for us. And the reality of His love helps to reveal that what the world's systems offer to us are just cheap and shallow substitutes for what our hearts really crave, what we're really longing for, to connect with someone much bigger than ourselves, much, much farther outside the scope of our own pettiness, who loves us, flaws and all, who loves us and wants what's best for us. All this stuff that seems so attractive about this world and its system loses its appeal in comparison to God's love for us, that He loves you and that it will never change. We don't have to recoil in fear from the world. Instead, let's draw close to God in love. And that is going to make the difference. That is what's going to make it clear in our lives that we're different from the broken world system. Let's live out that love by loving others, by representing that and presenting that healing option in the form of the good news, the gospel of Jesus Christ in this world. And that way we can reveal to those who are swept into the waters of Babylon a better city that God has in store. If we do that, if in being shaped by love and representing that love, we call out to the waters of Babylon, there's a better city for you if you'll go with us. If we can do that, I think we'll be fulfilling our mission in this world. Right on?
Yeah.
All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please? Father, a lot of heavy stuff today, and I just pray, Lord, that you, by your Spirit, reveal yourself, that you are able to distinguish between my humanity and your goodness and your love and your grace in this world. So I pray that you, by your Spirit, guide us and lead us and shape us into that representation of that good city, to being the good news people who represent your love in a broken world. Help us to do that, Father, as we submit to you. Shape our hearts for heaven. I pray that you do that for each person here. And we ask this in the authority of Jesus' name. Amen.